Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to episode 154. Our guest on this episode is Adam Carter, and he actually was able to conduct a research project for his master thesis that was the effects of a weighted backpack hike on accuracy with a compound bow. That's a pretty awesome school project. So we talk about Adam's research, his thesis, his summary, and his findings. And one cool thing that I took away from this episode is just some ideas on how I can conduct some of my own research, not for an academic purpose, but to truly test some things that I take for granted and to really look more critically at my shooting, at my fitness, and related topics as well. Before we dive into that, I want to thank Stephen Davis for some feedback he sent us for the podcast. And Stephen, we want to send you some Exo Mountain Gear and Hunt Backcountry podcast swag, so send us your shipping information. Listeners, if you want to enter into these giveaways, it's simple. We just want to hear from you. So whether you want to leave us a review in iTunes or wherever else you might be listening to this in terms of podcast platforms, or you just want to contact us directly, you can send an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. We'd love to hear your questions that you have about a future topic, maybe a guest suggestion, or any other feedback that you have like that. Okay, let's dive into this episode with Adam Carter. Adam, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, so we're excited to have you. We're going to dive into some research that you have done, but before we get into that, just to give listeners some context, what's kind of some introduction and background on you personally and kind of hunting and things like that?
Sure. The research we'll get into in a little bit was a research project that I did for my master's degree, which I completed this past May. Professionally, I work at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences here in Little Rock, Arkansas. I'm the fitness coordinator in the fitness center and wellness program that they offer to the students and employees at the university. And I've been doing that for the past 6 years. As far as my hunting experience goes, my hunting experience is mainly here in Arkansas, where I've lived for the last 14 years. Once every 3 years, I go up to Alberta where my parents live and I hunt up there with them. And so that's been the experience of my Western style of hunting so far has been in Alberta. This is actually one of those third years. So at the end of September, I'll be going up there to hunt with my dad and my brother, and we'll be chasing elk, and I'll also have an archery moose tag.
Dang, that's awesome, man.
Yeah, looking forward to it. I've had some great experiences hunting Alberta and been able to take a few nice trophies along the way.
That's awesome. So has it mainly been elk that you've done up there?
We started with elk on the 2015 trip. That was my first elk hunt, so this fall will be my second elk hunt. I ended up taking about a 270 class 6x6 bull with my rifle on that hunt in 2015. I'm the only bow hunter in my family, so I come from a family where I didn't really grow up doing that, so kind of self-taught myself starting in college with the bow hunting. In 2012, I was able to take a 210-inch mule deer on a deer hunt in November. And then a couple of years before that, when we did the trip 2006, I didn't fill a tag. My brother killed a nice whitetail that year. 2009, I ended up filling my doe tag, but didn't get my first real trophy buck, if you want to call it a trophy buck, till 2012 with that mule deer.
Cool. How does that work? I'm assuming you still have to get non-resident type tags then?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way it works in Alberta, if you want to go up without hiring a professional guide, you have to participate in their hunter host program. And the way that works is that you can be hosted by a resident of Alberta, provided that they are related to you either as direct family or they're related by marriage. And that's a once every 3 year program that you can do that, where the resident can act as your guide if you're coming up from the States. And with that program, you have to submit some extra paperwork. The hunter host program is limited to once every 3 years, both for the person coming in as a hunter and for the person acting as a hunter host. And so that's how we do that trip, since my parents live in the Calgary, Alberta area.
So that's why you're going every 3 years then.
Yes. I would love to make it every year, but if I want to go in those off years, coming up as a non-resident from the States, you have to hire a professional guide for that.
Okay. And is that for all species in Alberta? Or all the big game species?
That is for all big game species. You can go up there. I believe you can go up there for predator hunting as well as waterfowl without participating in that program. But if you want to participate in the hunter host program for big game, that's once every 3 years.
Huh. Interesting. That's Alaska has that rule, you know, in terms of family for some species and then not for others. But it's interesting to hear how, you know, other provinces and things handle that. That's interesting.
Yeah. And I believe with that hunter host program, you're limited to over the counter tags. I don't think you can apply for points and do draw hunts with that.
Cool. So let's, you mentioned, you know, your background in terms of at the university there, both with studies as well as your career. I'm curious, lead us into the master's project that you're working on, why we're having this conversation today. Tell us what it is. And at the same time, I'm curious to hear, was it difficult to get buy-in to make this idea part of your program?
That's a great question. The master's degree I worked on was in physical education. It's kind of an oddball project with that degree, in that I worked with adults for the research project instead of kids. Because at the master's level, with the way the field of kinesiology works, when you work on a master's program and you're doing research, they're more concerned about you learning the process of doing research with some kind of physical performance than as opposed to whether or not you work with a specific population of kids or adults. So I was able to get this approved to do it with adults, even though most people traditionally think of physical education as teaching in a classroom.
So give us the high level on what this thesis is and then why you chose it.
Sure. So the thesis is studying the effects of a weighted pack hike on accuracy with a compound bow. The reasoning behind this is pretty simple. As someone who is self-taught as a bow hunter, as an adult, who has limited experience bow hunting out west, and with my background being in the fitness industry, I have a very analytical mind. And so when I come to the challenge of preparing myself for something, I want to not just arbitrarily approach it with a random process. I want to be able to have concrete data that will supply a performance-driven goal and hopefully be able to build my preparation around that performance-building goal. And so with this project, my hope was to begin the process of quantifying and really being able to analyze under what circumstances hiking with a pack will influence your ability to be accurate with a compound bow.
That's awesome. I mean, you said pack, hiking with weight, shooting a bow. I mean, our ears are like peaked now. It's definitely something that we're interested in for sure. I think it's super fascinating to think of the effects of physical performance or other physical responses on accuracy, hiking with weight being one of them. And then obviously just, you know, high heart rate, whether that's from physical exertion or, you know, the quote unquote buck fever, you know, the heat of the moment. There's so many variables, but I think it's super interesting you narrowed into weighted hiking and how that might affect accuracy. So, you know, going into a thesis, you're always going to have some sort of hypothesis that you're then testing. So what were the hypothesis that you came up with for this thesis before you even did the testing?
So I had three hypotheses that I wanted to test. The first was that hiking over a specified distance without a weighted pack would not drastically cause a decrease in accuracy when you shoot after the hike. The second hypothesis was that as the weight of the pack increases, you would see a decrease in accuracy based upon fatigue from hiking with the weighted pack. And then the third thesis was that if you were to shoot immediately after concluding a hike, and then you shot again after you rested and allowed the participants to choose their length of time that they wanted to rest until they felt recovered, that you would see that length of recovery time increased as the participants used a heavier pack. And so I was really trying to quantify with that, is there a significant difference between shooting immediately after you complete a hike versus does having the opportunity to rest for a little bit work into your advantage?
Steve and I, neither of us are academics, and I'm sure many of the listeners aren't as well. How does this work with formulating these hypotheses for research? Is this literally just up to you thinking through, you know, here's potential outcomes that I see, or is there some sort of like scientific process to even coming up with these hypotheses?
That's a great question. When you do formal research, and in the way I presented the thesis that I sent to you to read, each scientific problem when you're going to do a research study has four basic steps. The first is identifying the problem and then determining the purpose behind how you want to go about trying to address that problem. The second is developing hypotheses. And the development of the hypotheses I'll get into in just a second. And then the third is actually coming up with a very specific method for testing those hypotheses and then collecting your data and then doing statistical analysis on those data to verify whether your hypotheses were correct or not. And so when you look at developing hypotheses, you try to go back and find research that people have done before you that is somehow comparable or related to the idea that you want to test. And so a big chunk of what I ended up doing as I was formulating these hypotheses was I spent about a 3-month period going over as many research journals on human performance that I could, finding as many articles as I could to read that were related to physical exertion, hiking with a heavy pack, related to marksmanship and accuracy and shooting under duress, both from physical fatigue and mental fatigue or mental challenges, to try and figure out how best to guide where I wanted to take my study. And that's probably the most time-consuming part of doing a research project, is looking for past research to see if there is enough of a foundation that you might be able to build off of so that you can make some accurate guesses with those hypotheses. A hypothesis in science is really just you're trying to make an educated guess of what you think is going to happen based upon some trends that you can observe in research that took place before you actually attempt your study.
Do you go into the testing and thinking ahead to conclusions as objectively as possible? Or even with your three hypotheses, did you kind of have like, I think it's going to be this one type thing?
It's ideally you go into it objectively, but people being people and me having my own personal biases, you always want to try and project what existing knowledge you have into the circumstances that you're trying to evaluate. And so I wanted to be objective in the sense that I was not going to be disappointed if my hypothesis turned out to be inaccurate, but at the same time, I had suspicions of what I thought might happen, but to be truly scientific and to do research properly, you have to be open-minded to the fact that what you may think ahead of time could be proven wrong.
Yeah. So we'll get to the conclusion after we talk about the testing, but I'm curious, what was your inclination going into this?
My inclination was that you would see a decrease in accuracy the heavier the pack got as people hiked. And we can talk about those results after we talk about the exact testing process. But that was my kind of my basic understanding. And you, on the surface, it seems to make sense. You're doing something physically demanding. You're going to get tired in that process. And theoretically, being physically tired should make any other physical activity you try to do after that more challenging.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the testing. How did you formulate the testing plan in terms of what is the protocol, and then how did you find participants, kind of the whole deal for actually structuring the testing?
Yeah, that's a great question. The most important part of developing a method for testing any hypotheses is that you have to have it very laid out, and it needs to be detailed enough that someone could repeat the process if they wanted to. And so when it comes to designing that for this study, what I ended up doing is I ended up choosing a shooting distance of 40 yards to have everyone test their accuracy at. And then because I was wanting to test accuracy after people hiked with a heavy pack, I had to know how good of a shot they were prior to doing that hike. And so basically what you would find in a rested condition as if you were just going to go to the practice range and shoot. And so to do that, I had a simple process where all my participants prior to hiking shot a total of 6 groups of 3 arrows each. We measured the size of each of those groupings as the largest distance between 2 of the 3 arrows. After we had those 6 groups, we averaged the size of those groups and called that the participants' pre-hike accuracy. We then randomly assigned the participants to one of 3 hiking conditions. They either hiked without a pack in an unloaded condition, they hiked with a pack equal to 10% of their body weight, or they hiked with a pack equal to 20% of their body weight. And then we sent everyone on a 2-mile hike. And then following that hike, when they got back to the range where we were doing the shooting, they had 2 minutes to remove their pack and shoot an immediate post-hike group of 3 arrows. They shot that group. I let them rest as long as they felt like they needed to recover from the exertion of the hike. And then I had them shoot 1 final grouping of 3 arrows after they had rested for as long as they felt necessary. And we measured the size of both the grouping immediately after the hike and then also after they had rested, and then put all that through statistical analysis to try and understand if there were changes in the accuracy occurring.
Okay.
For your test subjects, were they kind of a wide range of people, or are we talking like already very physically fit?
That's a great question. So I'll give you a quick rundown on the participants that I had. I ended up having 15 participants, and one of the ways I screened participants to make sure that they were qualified to do this testing was I had a survey they completed based upon their bow hunting experience or their 3D archery experience. And then we built a group of participants based on the feedback I got from those surveys. So of the 15 participants that I had, each participant had an average of just under 13 years experience of using a compound bow. They practiced an average of a little over 4 days per month. They were shooting on average about 24 arrows per practice session. And they had an average practice distance of about 45 yards.
Okay.
And so we took those participants and put them through the testing procedure.
Was it I'm assuming you relied on like a local bow club or a bow shop or something to kind of help identify these guys?
Yeah. So there was a couple different ways I recruited that. The first thing I did is I reached out to my friends who were able to, or how I knew bow hunted or competed in archery of some form. And then that gave me about 10 participants. And then to recruit the final 5, I ended up going to local archery shops and just putting up flyers advertising for people to contact me if they're interested in participating, and made some posts on local bow hunting groups, Facebook pages, asking for participants as well. And then was able to recruit a couple people from the local 3D club that I participate in the off season as well. So through that, it was mostly friends or friends of friends, and I was able to recruit some people as well just through those other efforts.
In terms of the testing protocol, you mentioned, you know, the 10% of body weight, 20% of body weight in terms of the loading, and then the 2 miles in terms of the distance of the hike. What were the reasons that you chose those loadings and distances?
So the reason I chose the loading, one of the things that I came across in conducting this study is that nobody's ever really done this type of study with a compound bow as the weapon. There's lots of research out there, mostly from military application, regarding hiking and accuracy with firearms and how physical fatigue may affect that. And one of the common themes that I saw with in reading that research that was more military-based is that most of that research indicated that about 30% of body mass, when the pack weight started hitting that point, that's when you started seeing the fatigue start causing significant changes in accuracy and marksmanship. And so I reduced that from my study down to 20%, just based on my personal experience that shooting a bow is harder than shooting a firearm. And so I kind of went into it with the assumption that, well, if at 30% is where that's where you start seeing a drop off in accuracy with a firearm, then probably it's going to be a little bit lower weight for accuracy with a bow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that 20% number is pretty reasonable in terms of the type of load that somebody might be carrying before the tag is filled. Anyway, obviously it's going to be heavier after the tag is filled, but before the shot, I mean, if you take 20% and then, you know, an individual between 150 to 200 pounds, you're talking a 30 to 40 pound load, which is pretty common.
Yeah. And that was also in the back of my mind. It was that it needed to be at a load that was realistic to what people would be carrying if they're in a backcountry hunting situation.
Yeah. The testing, I'm curious, before we get to the results, just the testing itself, we talked about what it was. How did the testing go? So the actual event, like, was it pretty structured and went off without a hitch, or was there any sort of like stories or mishaps or anything during the testing?
No, it pretty much went off without a hitch. The biggest challenge I had in pulling off this testing, because I was on a end of semester deadline to complete the project to complete my degree and graduate on time, one of the challenges I ran into is when you do a formal research project like this as a student or through a university, before you can actually begin testing your participants, you have to get approval from the Institutional Review Board, is what it's called, where I was going to school, or it's basically an ethics committee that wants to review your procedures to make sure you're not doing anything unethical or inhumane to the participants. And one of the challenges I ran into is we had a deadline of submitting the application for that of March 3rd in the spring. And we were told it would probably be a 2 to 3 week process to get that approval. And it ended up, for whatever reason, reasons I don't know, it took almost 7 weeks to get mine approval done. And so I was anticipating starting testing around April 1st and having the entire month of April and then the first couple of weeks of May to do my testing. I ended up not getting the approval for it till April 24th and then having to have all my testing completed by May 8th. So the only real challenge I had in pulling that off during that time frame was just getting everyone who volunteered scheduled in such a short amount of time, because I anticipated having 6 or 7 weekends to do this and then ended up with 2. So there's a bit of a scramble to get people tested in that short of a time frame. But other than that, the actual testing of everyone went off quite well.
Cool. Let's begin to talk about some of the results, the findings, the conclusions.
Yeah. So like I said, my first hypothesis was that hiking without a pack wouldn't create a major change in accuracy following the hike. And that was true. I was right on that hypothesis. You can, you know, if you're just going to walk around like you would at a 3D shoot, or if you're going in for, you know, a quick afternoon hunt, you can go in up to 2 miles, don't have any weight on you. You're not going to have to worry about your accuracy out to 40 yards, even if you get a shot immediately as you get to wherever it is you want to be hunting. The second hypothesis was that as the weight of the pack increased, you would start to see a decrease in accuracy with that arrow grouping that was fired immediately after concluding the hike. And that actually turned out to be false, which was kind of a surprise to me. Between our three conditions of testing, hiking without the pack, hiking with a 10% pack, or hiking with a 20% pack, there was no major difference in the sizes of their shot groupings at immediately after that 2 mile hike. And so we can talk about kind of the implications of that when we kind of get into some of the conclusions I draw. And then the third hypothesis of the recovery time getting longer as the pack got heavier, that also proved to be false. I was wrong on that hypothesis as well. There was not a big difference in recovery time between any of the three groups.
Interesting. So as you mentioned, your conclusions and then tying that into some takeaways for the listeners, what does the average bow hunter listening to this, what should they pull away from your research?
So the big pull away from here is that out to 40 yards on a 2 mile hike, you can be confident that you're not going to see a major change in accuracy due to the fatigue caused by the hike. If your pack is at 20% or less of your body weight. Now, the one caveat on that is that this hike was a pretty flat terrain hike. The changes in elevation on this hike were limited to less than 50 feet. And I did that on purpose because I didn't want major changes in elevation to be a factor in the accuracy. I simply wanted to limit the weight of the pack to be the influence on the potential changes in accuracy.
If you were to do this again, and not necessarily do this again, but if you were to do further studies, what are some of the additional variables you'd like to introduce, or maybe different approaches to that research altogether, just to change, whether that's shooting with the pack on or that is introducing elevation? Like, what are some of the other future research that you would either like to do or see done on this topic?
That's a great question. One of the things I would hope to do with continued research in this area is be able to put together a very well-defined guideline of what people should be able to expect as far as their accuracy when they are fatigued from hiking. And that can vary by distance. So it's a simple way to change up the study I did would be since I've kind of shown that 20% of your body weight is you can carry up to that without it causing major change after a 2 mile hike, would be to have people all wear 20% packs and then have them hike further distances, have a group hike 3 miles, have a group hike 4 or 5 miles, and then see if that weight over a further distance caused changes in accuracy. You could also look at doing the same distance hike, but doing it with heavier packs, so seeing if 30 or 40% weight packs were the upper limit of what you should carry with before it starts to influence your accuracy and make your shot become poor. And then, the big question obviously is changes in elevation. And I think that's probably the most interesting one for people that want to go hunt out west. It's the most interesting one to me, because living in Arkansas, our highest point in Arkansas is only 2,700 feet. So we don't really have to deal with major changes in elevation and physical exertion from climbing those kinds of elevations. So I think a lot of people who live either in the south or in the east or midwestern parts of the country, especially if they're going on their first western hunt, they really underestimate how much the mountains will fatigue you when you're not used to it. And so that to me is a big area of study as well that could be continued.
What do you think the role of research is or can be in the future of hunting? There's always, hunting's a super unique thing that there's always so many variables. No situation's ever the same. No encounter's ever the same. It seems like, no shot opportunity's ever the same. You have the physical aspects, you have weather, you have terrain, you obviously have the animals who can behaving different. There's endless variables, right? And part of research is always standardizing on some of these variables to produce some sort of consistent test. But I think this whole idea of research for hunting, whether it's on the physical performance side or some other aspect, is pretty interesting. How do you see that growing in the future, and how do you think it might benefit hunters?
That's a great question. I think as it grows in the future, obviously, as you mentioned, there's some variables that are just about impossible to account for with research. You can't control the weather when you're in an outdoor performance setting. You either have the ability to go in there and endure the weather if it's poor, or to enjoy it when it's good and do your best to perform under those circumstances. And you also can't account for the way animals are going to react to your presence in the woods, whether that be an elk ducking an arrow or moving as you shoot, or, you know, learning to properly play the wind to your advantage to get close enough for a shot to begin with. You have to control what you can, and what you can control is your ability and skills going into the hunt. And so I think with future research along the lines I mentioned already, if we can standardize some of those things and come up with some guidelines that people can follow and kind of prepare for, we can start helping people better prepare with realistic performance in mind. And hopefully what that would lead to is better physical preparation so people enjoy their hunting experience, but also more importantly, being able to take more ethical shots and reduce the potential for a poor shot that would cause the loss of the animal or not being able to recover the animal. But also at the same time, making sure, you know, you've got your best chance of being successful when your shot opportunities are presented. So that's the immediate benefit to hunters. I think there's also a potential for benefit for us in the eyes of society as a whole, especially the non-hunting public. One of the things I've really become aware of in the last couple of years, listening to your podcast and a few others, especially people like Shane Mahoney and Randy Newberg, is even though I've hunted my whole life, I never really appreciated or understood just what a vital role we as hunters play in keeping our wildlife system here in North America as productive as it is. And I think one of the things we need to do is to better educate ourselves on that past and that history that we have. But we also need to have an eye towards the future and making sure we're doing everything we can to represent ourselves well in the non-hunting public's eyes. And I think one of the ways that we could consider doing that is being prepared as possible, but not just having kind of anecdotal opinions. I mean, it's great to sit and listen to people that have experience, but if you're that person that hasn't had the experience, it's also helpful when you know there's kind of a preset standard that you can say, okay, I need to be prepared to this level before I go attempt this, because I owe it to the animal and I should be respecting the animal enough to be at my best that I possibly can be when I do go.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. One of the takeaways from this conversation, which I didn't even think of this ahead of time, but one of the things I'm interested in now is the fact that this idea that you've presented with this test is something that listeners can take away from, not learning from your conclusions, but taking away the idea to actually test themselves in this own way. And I don't mean on the specific protocol that you outlined, but in all kinds of ways. The cool thing about this is we can perform our own research with ourselves being the test subject. We don't need a hypothesis. We don't need, this written formal academic protocol. We can just begin to think outside the box and go, what does happen to my accuracy if I do this or if I do that? Or, you know, it's one of those things where it's been talked about to make practice realistic. You could shoot with a higher heart rate and stuff like that. But man, this opens up my ideas to many more scenarios of, oh, we could try this and I could just try it on myself and see how it goes. And I think it is really interesting is there's always that conversation out there about what is your max effective range, like what are you willing to shoot game at? And that's always, again, situational. But I think by doing some more testing on ourselves, if you will, we can get a much better idea of what does happen to my shooting under this exact type of variable, because we've tested that for ourselves.
Yeah, and I think whether we do that as individuals or whether there is an established kind of standardized industry acceptance of how that performance should look going into a hunting scenario. When we start taking that proactive approach and taking that upon ourselves, if hunting ever does get more controversial in the non-hunting public's eyes than it has been at times in the last few years, us as collective group of hunters having the initiative to say, well, we're doing everything we can to be prepared, and we're not just playing games with this, we're taking it seriously. That's going to be, I think, a determining factor in how long we get to have hunting. Because I think if you look at kind of how anti-hunters have propagated themselves through media over the last few years, they often come across as hysterical. And I think in the average non-hunting public person's eyes, the way you counter that is by showing that you're willing to take the initiative to test and prepare yourself, and to show that you're doing everything you have in your power to be as ethical in the killing process, because that's what hunting is. And if people see us as being lazy or unprepared, or not willing to take the time to consider doing what's best for the animal in that circumstance, I think we stand in danger as a collective group of society, as hunters, of losing that privilege someday.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's good stuff, Adam. Certainly appreciate it. Do you have any plans for future research? I know that, as you mentioned, the program's over, you completed your master's. Is this something that you want to continue to pursue?
Absolutely. I know, I mentioned a few different ideas on how I think future research could go. So those ideas are in the back of my mind, and just formulating a plan of how to start conducting that is the next step. The biggest challenge to research of any kind, whether it's what I do or whether you're talking about research in medicine or pharmaceutical industries, it's always the challenge of finding participants who are willing and then finding the funding to pull it off. So, yeah, those are two obstacles to look at and overcome. I was fortunate with this study that most of these people were friends who just volunteered a couple hours out of their time and didn't expect any kind of compensation for it. But, real research, if it's going to be done right, needs to be prepared to reward people for their participation and help. So,
yeah. Awesome. Nice. Well, appreciate you joining us today. And if you do any further research or even stumble across some cool research that would help us as hunters, be sure to let us know.
All right. Well, I appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity to come on and talk about this. Been a long time listener and really enjoyed the material you guys have been putting out over the summer. And hopefully this will be another good contribution to that.
Well, thanks for tuning in on this one, guys. I know that we are wrapping up 2018, getting close to Christmas and looking forward to the new year. We have some big things planned for the show in 2019. So make sure you hit subscribe for some chances to let the cat out of the bag a little bit. You're going to be able to win some awesome gear throughout the entire year in 2019. So make sure you subscribe. We'll catch you on the next one.